This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.
Good evening and welcome everybody. I'd like to welcome Congresswoman Hageman, if you could all rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Congresswoman Hageman.
Thank you so much. Come on up here. We're going to have someone to start us in prayer today.
Thank you. Can you bow your heads, please? Heavenly Father, bless this gathering and guide our discussions this evening. Help us to be respectful of each other as we give thanks for the many blessings that we have in this great country, including leaders that strive to keep your laws. In your holy name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much. Thank you. It is so wonderful to be back here. The House is currently in its Passover and Easter recess, and before that we were in session for 3 weeks, and on Sunday I will be returning to Washington, D.C., and I will be there until the end of May. I enjoy coming into these communities and having the opportunity to do town halls. I spent a lot of time in meetings and, in fact, was in quite a few meetings today and will be so again tomorrow. But town halls, I think, are something that are really special because it gives me the opportunity to come here, give you an update on what is going on in Washington, D.C., and then also to engage with you and answer the questions that are of interest to you. We're going to do something just a little bit different this time. We ask people to write questions, and at the end of my remarks, which will be about 15, 20 minutes, then I'm going to reach in here and just randomly pick questions and answer those to the best extent that I can, and then just engage with you and again address the issues that are so important. This is a great turnout. Thank you for being here. It was a little cold today, but I can't say enough how excited I am to be here with a little bit of moisture. As you know, that I'm from the southeastern part of the state, and boy, it is so dry down there. I was just in Torrington and Goshen County yesterday, and I was also there for the Easter holidays. So first, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now. And we're going through what is called the budget reconciliation process. This is not something that I knew very much about before I came to Congress, because it's actually not something that we have the opportunity to do very often. Typically, we only do a budget reconciliation process when you have the President, the Senate, and the House all in the same hands. So the last time it was done was the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. We know what happened with that. Inflation skyrocketed, but that's what it was called, and that was done a couple of years ago while Joe Biden was the President. We're approaching it a little bit differently, but we still have a framework in which we have to work. What this does is it allows us to do expedited consideration for certain tax, spending, and debt limit legislation. And I will stay right out of the box, because I know that this is a question for many people. I get it all the time. We cannot touch Social Security through the budget reconciliation process. So I know that that is an issue for people. It has been elsewhere. Social Security is not a part of this particular process. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be an effort to do some waste, fraud, and abuse review at a different time, but that is not what we are focusing on with this. It's called the Byrd Rule, and the Byrd Rule does not allow us to touch Social Security. Under the first Trump administration, we actually had the House and the Senate for a short period of time as well, and they looked at the priorities with the major tax cuts and terminating enforcement of certain Obamacare penalties. In November, the American people elected President Trump, flipped the Senate, and we retained the House. Reconciliation will be used to allow us to deliver on the promises that we made during the election last year, which is to secure the border, unleash American energy, which is so incredibly important for Wyoming, and reduce the size and scope of the federal government, which is something that I have talked about for years and years and years. This is a two-step process. The first is that Congress must agree to a budget resolution, and that provides the blueprint or the rules for what we have to do in the reconciliation process. And then we will draft the actual bills which meet those instructions so that it is those bills that become law. Over the last couple of months, we've been taking some interesting votes, and it seems like there's a bit of brinkmanship about, well, is the House going to be able to pass their budget resolution? Is the Senate going to pass it? And we have so far been able to leap over each one of those hurdles to be able to, so that we can keep moving forward in this process. On February 25th, I voted for the House budget resolution, which requires at least $1.5 trillion in mandatory savings, up to $300 billion of additional spending for border security, and it would also prevent $4.5 trillion in tax hikes, and it would also increase the debt limit by $4 trillion. The Senate amended and sent that bill back to the House. I felt that we had a better bill, but the President got behind what the Senate did. And so in order to make sure that this process continues to go forward, and after having an opportunity to meet with the President, I voted in favor of that bill. Again, that is not the budget. That is the budget resolution that allows us to go to the next step, which is what we will be starting next week. After Easter, I expect that the House will quickly begin our steps to craft the actual bills. And I expect that the Judiciary Committee, of which I am a member, we will be one of the very first committees to actually go to work on the budget. So what we have is when you have the bill itself, each committee is identified for addressing specific issues. So a Judiciary Committee has jurisdiction over immigration in this country. So the Judiciary Committee has been instructed that we can spend an additional $110 billion under this process for such things as building the wall, constructing additional beds for detention, hiring additional immigration judges, and those kinds of things. So the Judiciary Committee will actually be spending more money through this process, whereas other committees will be reducing the amount of money that we spent. In terms of our lawmaking exercise for the 119th Congress, I have been actively involved in this process from the very beginning. To say that this is complicated is actually really an understatement. We had to spend quite a bit of time even understanding how the process works, because everything has to fit together like a puzzle. So we have to do one thing before the next thing can go forward, and another thing before the next thing can go forward. But one of the things that I've done and that my team has done is we have focused on those issues that are really critically important to the state of Wyoming. So I had an opportunity to meet with the President for a couple of hours right before I came home for the Easter break. And I identified three priorities for me that I believe need to be in that reconciliation bill for us to be able to move forward. One is to generate revenue from federal energy and mineral projects in Wyoming. So that would be to terminate the Buffalo and Rock Springs RMPs. I know many of you are familiar with those. They were done over the last 2 years. The Rock Springs RMP covers 3.8 million acres of land in southwestern Wyoming. It substantially reduced recreation, grazing, energy development on a huge swath of southwestern Wyoming. The Buffalo RMP is even more damaging in the sense that what it did is basically say we will do no more coal mining in the entire Powder River Basin by 2041. But 2041 is really irrelevant, because the way that our permitting goes forward is that our mines, our producers, have to be entering into contracts right now in order to be producing 5 and 8 and 10 years down the road. It takes 8 to 10 years to get the permits in place at a minimum of $40 million just to even start the process. So what happens when you've got a date sitting out there that says after 2041, we're no longer going to be doing any coal mining in the Powder River Basin? By the way, we're the largest coal producers in the entire nation, so you're talking about a huge impact on our ability to produce energy. What it was doing is it will dry up capital for our companies, for our producers. So this is something that is incredibly important. Right now, Doug Burgum has put a hold on both the Rock Springs and the Buffalo RMPs, but I want that to be permanent. So I have asked that these be put within the reconciliation process so that we can generate revenue both in southwestern Wyoming and within the Powder River Basin. I also have included as one of my priorities is requiring mandatory minimum lease sales for oil and gas, and also removing leasing restrictions, as I just talked about, other leasing restrictions within the Powder River Basin coal. As you know, the last administration placed a moratorium and restrictions on leasing for coal, even outside of the Buffalo RMP, so I'm trying to get those lifted as well. I also want to see reduced federal spending by repealing the codification of the endangerment finding. And the endangerment finding was probably the most expensive regulation ever adopted in the history of the United States. It was done in 2009 under the Obama administration. What the endangerment finding did was determine that CO2 and methane are gases, greenhouse gases, and they destroy the environment. The endangerment finding is the head of the snake. It is the foundation for all things global warming and climate change. It was done by regulation. It was never adopted by Congress until 2 years ago or 3 years ago when under the Biden administration they tried to codify it through the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. So my staff, individually as well as working with outside groups, we have combed through the entire IRA and we have found all of the places where they attempted to codify the endangerment finding. And part of what I'm trying to do is scrape all of that out so that there is not a statutory foundation for that. So one of the rules that we can follow is that for anything that was done by reconciliation, we can undo by reconciliation. So this is another one of my priorities to make sure that we can continue to produce affordable and reliable energy. Then the last one is to reduce the $2 trillion annual spending on regulations. There was a report issued today. It's called 10,000 Commandments. The estimate for regulations for the 2024 year was almost $2.2 trillion in hidden costs that we all pay. Those are things like the tailpipe restrictions, EV mandates, restrictions on our ability to buy gas stoves, the different requirements on our coal and oil and gas companies. The regulatory burden in this country is over $2.1 trillion annually. So one of the things that I have been working on, both as a private attorney as well as in my capacity as your representative, is I have been trying to find a way, and I've been working diligently, to take power away from the unelected representatives and return it to our legislative branch where it belongs. That's the way that our Constitution is set up, is that it is the legislative branch that should be legislating, not the executive branch. So I want what's called the RAINS Act to be put within reconciliation. What the RAINS Act says is that for any regulation that has an economic impact, direct or indirect, of over $100 million, it cannot go into effect unless it is approved by Congress. So it forces that authority and responsibility back within the congressional, the legislative branch. Now I'll tell you, I'd like the number to be lower. I think $100 million is too high, although almost every regulation that the feds adopt anymore, when you look at both their indirect and their direct impacts, they have an enormous impact on our economy. Every person in this room, your household spends about $16,000 a year on regulatory impacts. It's the highest outlay of any outlay that you have. Your highest cost is typically your housing, The cost of regulations is number two. Again, it's a hidden tax of about $16,000 per household. My view of that is if we're going to impose that against you, we're the ones who ought to be accountable for it. It ought to be the legislative branch that takes responsibility. And then you can make you can come to a town hall and you can talk to me about it. You can talk to me about the different laws that we're passing. But right now, you don't necessarily even know who's buried in the EPA or the Forest Service or the BLM that are making decisions that have huge impacts on our economy. So that's the other thing that I visited with the president about. It's very important that the RAINS Act, or at least a portion of it, be included in reconciliation. Since we began in January, the 119th Congress, we have passed five different laws, the Lake and Riley Act, which mandates the detention for illegal aliens who are arrested for theft, assault of a police officer, and other crimes resulting in death and serious injury. Yes. I have the great honor of being able to attend the president's signing of the executive order with the Lake and Riley Act. And it was very, very emotional. Her parents were there, her sister. There were several other mothers, angel mothers, that were there as well. Jocelyn Nungary's mother was there. I've had the opportunity to visit with her a couple of times. She was that beautiful young 14-year-old down in Texas. And so I think that this was just a really incredible opportunity to be a part of that. We've also done the continuing resolution. The continuing resolution will keep our government open through September 30th. I'm not a fan of continuing resolutions. I'm pretty frustrated by the fact that we can't seem to do our job and get our budgets done. But I have found that in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of people who really like to govern by omnibus spending bills. 2,000, 3,000 page omnibus spending bills, because that way we don't ever get to go in there and look at what they're doing. And it's not a way to run a country. It's why we're almost $37 trillion in debt. This is unsustainable. But at the same time, in an inflationary situation, actually voting for a continuing resolution over time is going to reduce spending. So I voted in favor of it because it did avoid a shutdown. And one of the things that I have learned since I've been back there is if you shut down the government, number one, it costs massive amounts of money to reopen. Can't explain all of the reasons as to why that is. But the other thing is that you have to negotiate so much away to get the votes to reopen the government. Now, I personally believe that if you were to shut down the government, we would do it in such a way to try to minimize impact on everybody, make sure Social Security checks are still going out, make sure that we are continuing to pay veterans and for our military, make sure that we are covering Medicare, Medicaid, all of those kinds of things. That is not how it has historically been done back there. I think the last one that you saw was in 2013, and I remember seeing pictures of pylons being put in front of the open-air monuments back in Washington, D.C., that typically anybody could walk through. But to try to punish us for shutting down the government, now I wasn't there, but to try to punish for shutting down the government, they were trying to block people from even accessing the Lincoln Monument, which you can any day of the week that you want to. Some of the other things we've been doing is what's called Congressional Review Act bills. What this does is it allows us to have an expedited plan of action so that we can undo some of the most egregious regulations that came out at the end of the Biden administration. The Biden administration, prior to him, the most rulemaking presidency in our history was under President Obama. And in his last year in office in 2016, there were over 95,000 pages of regulations published in the Federal Register. 95,000 pages. The last year for under President Biden, 2024, was almost 120,000 pages. 10,000 pages of regulations a month came out of that administration in 2024. Under the Congressional Review Act, we can vote to reverse some of those, and when the House votes to reverse some of those, the Senate is required under an expedited manner to take those up and actually vote on them, and we've had some bipartisan support getting rid of some of those regulations. The other one is the House has also passed what's called the No-Row Rulings Act, I may very well get some questions about this tonight. You know, prior to going to Congress, I was a practicing trial attorney for 34 years. And I had a lot of cases against the federal government, primarily federal agencies in the water and natural resource and land management areas. In that entire time, I received one nationwide injunction, and it was against the Forest Service in 2001 related to the roadless rule. And we were talking just today about the roadless rule and the impact that that has had on this community and the catastrophic fires that we suffered last summer as a result of that. And when I sued, I was hired by the state of Wyoming to file that lawsuit, and when I sued, I asked for a nationwide injunction, and I eventually won that. I got a nationwide injunction. Those were extremely rare. They're very rare, and they should be, because a district court judge is supposed to only adjudicate the cases for the people who are in front of him or her. So if I go before a district court judge, whatever that ruling is really only applies to me. Then it can go up to the appellate level, but it is still only applying to the parties before that judge. What has happened here with the nationwide injunctions that are being issued over the last couple of months is that our district courts are acting as a United States Supreme Court. But they're acting alone, whereas with the United States Supreme Court, you at least have to convince 5 out of 9 people. In this circumstance, we have judges, and the people who are filing these lawsuits, they know which judges to go to. They're forum shopping, which is illegal in and of itself, but that's what they're doing. They're forum shopping. They're getting one district court judge in one location make a decision that applies to every single one of us nationwide. Now, why is that also important? Because the Supreme Court doesn't typically take cases unless there is a split in the circuits. If you have one district court judge in California or Washington, D.C., making a decision, it becomes that much more difficult to even get it up to the next level for review. So there are many, many reasons why nationwide injunctions are inappropriate. I do believe that the Supreme Court is probably going to step in here shortly and say that. But in the meantime, we also have acted, and I am a co-sponsor of the bill that with very limited exceptions, district court judges do not have the authority to issue nationwide injunctions. As I mentioned a moment ago, I'm on the Judiciary Committee. I'm also on the Natural Resources Committee. And for Judiciary, I'm on the Subcommittee on the Administrative State, Regulatory Reform, and Antitrust. And I'm also on the Constitution and Limited Government Subcommittee. In terms of some of the more interest for Wyoming, I am now the chair of the Subcommittee on Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries under Natural Resources. So I oversee everything from the Endangered Species Act to Bureau of Reclamation to a lot of the agencies that have huge impacts in Wyoming. That's why I wanted that. We've already had several hearings. Next week, we're going to have an additional hearing on Wednesday about water infrastructure, primarily in the West. Our water infrastructure out here that was built by the Bureau of Reclamation, it's 100 to 120 years old. You know, the Buffalo Bill Dam is the first reservoir built under the 1902 Reclamation Act. Pathfinder Reservoir is the first one permitted and the second one constructed in the United States. Those facilities are 110 years old. And we're starting to see some pretty serious wear and tear on them, especially in light of the fact that water is such an erosive constituent in and of itself. So I want to make sure, one of my priorities over the next 2 years is to make sure that we are rebuilding, that we are protecting, that we are maintaining, that we are constructing, and that we are protecting these resources. I often say that when they built these facilities 100 years ago, they were not building them for themselves, they were building them for us. And the prosperity that has been created as a result of that is just really mind-blowing. We need to make sure that we're also maintaining this infrastructure for the next generation and the next generation after that. So next Wednesday, I will be holding a hearing of my subcommittee, bringing people in so that they can start talking to us about what the condition of this infrastructure is throughout the West and what we need to be doing in the long term to make sure we're appropriating sufficient funds to take care of it. I am also a chairman of the RSC, or the Republican Study Committee's Article 1 Task Force. The purpose of that, again, is to try to help our legislative branch retake its authority as the lawmaking body in the United States Congress. So I have been working, doing a lot of different seminars, educational programs for my fellow representatives, talking about the Constitutional Foundation, as well as just giving them a better understanding of how the regulatory regime has grown up over the last 100 years, but more specifically over the last 30 to 40. I work with some great people back there, but most of them have not been immersed in this area the way that I have for the last 25 years of my life. And so it's been wonderful to be able to talk to them about what really happens in this regime and what we need to do to correct it so we get back to the constitutional foundation of separation of powers. On the first day in office, I introduced what is called the First Amendment Accountability Act, and that is to make sure that we can hold our officials liable if they violate our First Amendment. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, and freedom to petition your government for redress. You know, you look at what happened during COVID, and the fact is, all five of those were violated on a daily basis. And I know that there were concerns, there were fears, there were all kinds of things associated with that. But if there's any time that your constitutional rights ought to protect you, it's when there's a crisis. And when I look at what happened with shutting down our churches, shutting down our businesses, keeping our children out of school, it was absolutely catastrophic. And the more that we learn about it, the more we learn that our so-called officials and betters were lying to us. They lied to us about the 6 foot. They lied to us about an awful lot of things. I want to make sure that that never happens again. So I have introduced the First Amendment Accountability Act. Thank you. As far as casework, one of the other things that we do is we have the legislative side of things that I've kind of described here, the work I'm doing back in Washington, D.C., with the bills and the committee work and the task force, that sort of thing. But it's also important to understand that we also do constituent services. And that is an incredibly important part of what we do for people right here in Wyoming. So I have a team not only here in Wyoming, but we do constituent services out of Washington, D.C. as well. Just to give you an idea, now these are with the agencies. I spent 2 hours today with the Sheridan, 2.5 hours with the Sheridan VA today. Had a great conversation and addressed some of the concerns that I've heard about over the last 2.5 years, or 3 years, even before being elected. But this is working with the IRS, working with Passport Services, working with the VA, working with Social Security, all of these various agencies. If you have an issue with a federal agency, please get a hold of my office. Talk to us about what the issue is. We can set up a case, we can get a hold of the agency, and we can see what kind of solutions we can provide for you. To date, we have solved nearly 3,300 cases on behalf of individuals in the state of Wyoming, and we have returned $6.8 million to constituents right here in Wyoming. So that is to our small businesses. That is to our individuals. That's a $2,500 that the IRS was failing to refund with a tax refund. That was a situation where a gentleman had reached a settlement with a federal agency for $37,000 or $38,000, and they wouldn't write the check. So we got involved and made sure that the agencies were actually carrying through on what they were supposed to do. Our veterans not getting their prescriptions or their medications reimbursed or travel reimbursed. So these are not typically high dollar situations. They might be a $2,500 IRS check or a $600 mileage check or expense coming through the VA. So I'm extremely proud of my team, and I have two members here tonight. Many of you know Trinity Lewis in the back, and then I also have, yeah, she's wonderful. And I also have Nicholas here. He is with me as well. He's actually with me back in Washington, D.C., but he came out to deal with some of the VA issues with me today. I'm incredibly proud of the team that we have, both here in Wyoming and in D.C., and this is one of the reasons why. I think some of the very best services that we can provide is to be that liaison between you and the federal agencies. It can be incredibly daunting and complicated to have to deal with some of these agencies, and so let us help you. Again, if there's something we can do for you, please let us know, and we'll see if we can get something resolved. In 2025 alone, we have returned $2.2 million to constituents, and we've resolved over 700 cases just in the last 4 months. So again, let us help you. With that, that kind of gives you an overview of what I've been doing, what we've been doing, what's happening in Washington, D.C., and I think this would be a really good time. I'm just going to open it up for questions, and as I indicated, I'm just going to pull random questions out of the box here. I'll read them, and then I'll give you the information that I have. So this question is, you voted for the SAVE Act. What are married women expected to provide in order to vote? Has there been any evidence of voting fraud in Wyoming? Are we spending a lot of time and energy on something that isn't a problem in Wyoming? One of the things, I just got a memo. I don't know who gave me this question or who asked this question, but I have a memo on my phone and I don't have it up here, answering every one of those questions. There is an entire list of all of the things that can be done and that are easy to do in order to be able to make sure that you can register to vote. But also keep in mind, it doesn't apply to the folks who are already registered. So like me, or like someone, Trinity Lewis, when you changed your name, when you got married, there were a variety of documents that you had to change to show your married name. So I find it very interesting that people are concerned that women are incapable of finding a way to make sure that they can register to vote and have the documentation necessary to be able to do so. I don't see that as an issue. I think women are smart enough to be able to do that. And as far as, most of the women that I know, if not all the women that I know, are fully capable of being able to register to vote and show the documentation. I find it rather sexist to claim otherwise. As far as voter fraud, you know, one of the concerns you have to recognize is that when you allow 12.5 million illegal aliens into the country in a four-year period, one of the areas that you're going to have an issue with potentially is voting. So when you say, is there voter fraud? Yes. In fact, they've been prosecuting people just over the last couple of months with illegal aliens who were not entitled to vote in elections. I believe they were just prosecuted 6 people in Ohio for that very reason. And again, I have the information, the more detailed data on my telephone. I forgot I should have brought that up here. Trinity, if you want to grab my work phone, I can answer that question in more detail a little bit later. I'll move on to something else right now. But I actually think election integrity is one of the most incredibly important things that we can deal with. We don't want illegal aliens voting in our elections, and we don't want people who are not entitled to vote in our elections. So whatever it takes to make sure that that doesn't happen, I think is absolutely appropriate. I'll ask the next question. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to answer this question. The stock market has done nothing but tank since Inauguration Day, and Trump promised to lower prices on day one. Can you explain why he hasn't delivered on that promise and has instead made things worse? Well, a couple of things. I think that the stock market rallied by 1,000 points today, was that right, or yesterday? And I think that you're going to see some cyclical changes. I'm not going to stand up here and try to say that you're not going to see some swings and some things, because he's actually changing. He's actually having an impact on things that we need to address. We're $37 trillion in debt. If we're not willing or not able to change course with the way that we're running this government, I think that we're delusional to believe that we're going to continue to have the prosperity that we do. In terms of inflation, and inflation and the stock market are not the same thing, but in terms of inflation, I believe that the price of eggs, just as an example, has come down by about 50%. But also keep in mind that part of that was associated with the fact that they were killing chickens. So when that happens, I mean, that's going to increase the cost of it. The so-called Inflation Reduction Act actually skyrocketed inflation, and we've all suffered for it over the last several years. I think one of the most important things that Wyoming can do and what we bring to the table is with our energy production. I'm extremely excited about where Wyoming is, and I'm incredibly optimistic about the future of Wyoming. Every single day, our demand for energy in this country increases. Every single day. We're not going to get to a point where energy demand goes down. And one of the other things that we need to do is we're going to have to stay at the forefront when it comes to AI. Our two biggest competitors in terms of controlling AI are China and most likely Saudi Arabia. And the reason is because they have the affordable energy. So if we're going to stay at the forefront and be the leaders in that industry, we're going to have affordable, reliable energy. Wyoming is a huge part of that. I'm extremely proud of what we will be doing. I'm looking forward to, I was at the White House 2 weeks ago for the president's signing of the executive orders unleashing coal production in America. I'm really excited about what he was doing in that regard. Uranium, Wyoming has some of the highest reserves, highest quality uranium in the United States. That's another area where I think it's going to be absolutely incredible to be able to tap into that resource. So you keep saying in the press that 70% of Wyoming voters support Trump. So 70% voted for him, but can you honestly say that 70% support this dumpster fire of an administration? No one signed up for this. Well, I would disagree. This is exactly what I signed up for. And the reason I say that is if we continue down, all we have to do, you know, I think that this is a moment in history where you can look at what is happening in Europe and you can look at what is happening in America, and there is such a direct contrast of the trajectory of where we're going. There is such a direct contrast. The malaise, the attack on the First Amendment and freedom of speech, the depression, the mechanization, the deindustrialization of Europe is just absolutely not only stunning and shocking, but it is incredibly sad when you think about the importance of Western civilization and what Europe stands for. What England and France and Germany has totally deindustrialized. England is on the brink of collapse because of the cost of energy, and now they have come up with the idea that they are going to find a way to block the sun. Now, I don't know, does anybody see that going bad here? I look at these policy decisions that are being made by our counterparts in Europe, and I think, why do you think that that would be in the best interest of not only the current generation, not only, let's say, our seniors, but why would that be a good business model for our 20-year-olds, our 30-year-olds, our 40-year-olds, our 50-year-olds? Germany has entirely deindustrialized because of the nonsense surrounding global warming and climate change. You look at what is happening in these countries, and I think that the contrast is stark. And I will tell you that I will take the disruption, I will take the situation that we're in right now, the dynamic, the situation, any day over what they're doing in Europe. This is what is going to get us out. This is what is going to help us to deal with a $37 trillion debt. This is what is going to help us so that these young children right here can start businesses when they're 22 years old, so that they can own homes, so that they have opportunities. We cannot go down the road of continuously saying, yeah, we'll fix it next year. We'll fix it next year. We'll fix it next year. Next year is now. This is the opportunity for us to actually fundamentally change the trajectory of this country. And we have to take the opportunity to do that. Are there going to be a spike in egg prices? Maybe. Is there going to be a decrease in the stock market? Yes. But where was everybody screaming when you saw the impact during COVID? Where was everybody screaming when we took people's jobs away during COVID? Where was everybody screaming when we destroyed restaurants during COVID? Where was everybody screaming when they prevented people from going to work during COVID? You weren't screaming then. You weren't screaming. Now, you guys all were. You were. But what I'm saying is, you look at the situation for 4 months. We have lived through years of them telling us you have to be six feet apart, or you can't run a restaurant. I still go into restaurants, and you look, there should be 8 tables in an area. There are 4 because they are not allowing these businesses to conduct themselves. So when I look at when I look at what this administration is doing, and I look at his effort to help us to better manage our forests, when I look at this administration's willingness to say coal is the energy of the future, when I look at this administration who says we need affordable, reliable energy or we cannot run our businesses, we cannot manufacture anything in this country, I say, hallelujah. This is exactly what I signed up for. A 29-year-old Kilmer Garcia, married to a U.S. citizen and father of 2 children, was arrested, denied due process, and sent to a prison in El Salvador. The Supreme Court ordered his return, and the current administration has ignored their ruling. Can you please pressure the administration to grant due process to all people and ask for Kilmer's return? No. First of all, he was given due process. In fact, 2 different immigration judges ruled that he was a member of MS-13 and could be deported. That's due process. Number 2, the Supreme Court did not order his return. They ordered, in fact, they reversed the district court, and they said, they used the word facilitate, which I have never heard of a writ of facilitation, but oh well. And as far as due process, I'm not sure what you are talking about or what you mean by due process.
Are you kidding me?
Yes, no, I'm not. Due process, yes, I am. Due process is notice and an opportunity to be heard. And he was given notice and an opportunity to be heard. So here's the question that I have, or the point I'd like to make. If he had been sent to Guatemala, what would you be saying?
Same thing.
Well, see, that's why your position doesn't make any sense. Because the only issue has to do with whether he was rightfully sent to El Salvador. So that is the only issue here. So if you're going to use somebody as your poster child, again, I don't know that I would have picked him. But what I will say is that as far as immigration law goes, the president and the executive branch have an enormous amount of authority of making the decision of how they are going to address this. And again, this goes back to the nationwide injunctions that are being issued. This is eventually going to percolate up to the Supreme Court because it is going to have to. And what you're going to find is that the Supreme Court is going to rule that the administration, the Department of Homeland Security, these various agencies have the authority to make the decision about illegal aliens, especially criminally illegal aliens, and deporting them from the country.
Yeah.
address a ban on Congress people trading stock. You know, I think that that is an important issue. I don't control any of that. I obviously have a retirement because I had to fund my own retirement. As far as banning them from trading stocks, I don't necessarily have a position on that.
But there was an act that was introduced.
I just don't.
What about the act that was introduced last fall? Do you support that act?
Why are you afraid to allow your constituents to speak at this town meeting? So one of the things that I've always enjoyed town halls. I've always really enjoyed them because it has allowed me to engage and interact with my constituents. It's just too bad that there are certain people who have really ruined that for everyone. And I think we're seeing some of that this evening. The fact is that everyone has always been very, very respectful during these, even with people who have disagreed with me. And this year there is definitely a change, and people don't want to have the respectful exchange of ideas. So when I did my first round of town halls and had a really horrific, started primarily in Rock Springs, and there were over 300 people there, and there were about 40 people who were bound and determined that they were going to disrupt me. And they were screaming about First Amendment rights and things, and the point that I made is you don't have the heckler's veto. I have the right to speak, you have the right to listen, we have the right to engage with each other. But what has happened is between that and then what happened in Laramie and what happened in Wheatland is that there has been a concerted effort, and it's obvious here tonight, there has been a concerted effort to prevent me from engaging with my constituents. So the reason that we did this is because we wanted to actually be transparent. There is not one question that I have read or that I have answered tonight that was a friendly question. I am answering the questions as I take them out of the box. That's what I'm doing, because we've been accused of me planting questions. We've been accused that I won't take questions from unfriendlies. I think that's fairly obvious that that's untrue. But what I'm not going to allow to happen is what happened in Laramie, where it devolves into a screaming and yelling match, especially with children in the room, where people throw profanities at me and act like that is engaging in an adult conversation. So what we decided to do is this time I would answer the questions as they were written in the box. I'm answering the questions. I do not believe, though, that you have the right to stand up here and scream at me or yell at me when I'm answering the questions you've written down. I'm not going to get to all of these. I'm not going to get to everyone. But this is the way that we decided to do this so that we could at least continue to have a dialogue. This is what we came up with because it's people who are screaming that make it difficult for everyone else to engage. Thank you. Thank you. What is the amount? Okay, was the amount of money the United States government paid to El Salvador to imprison alleged gang members $3 million or $6 million? Was that a one-time payment, or is it reoccurring? If it is reoccurring, is that annual, monthly, or for how long? I don't have the answer to that question. We can find out. Whoever asked this question, if you would like to get a hold of my office, I'll put this one in my pocket. If you'd like to get a hold of my office over the next couple of days, we can find out how much has been spent on sending these criminals to El Salvador. BLM resource management plans identify public land that's available for disposal through sales or exchanges because those parcels meet the criteria as set forth in the Federal Land Policy Management Act, or FLIPMA. Are you advocating sale of BLM lands not already identified in an RMP, and will you circumvent FLIPMA to get parcels pushed through? I'm not sure that I fully understand this question, but I think you're asking whether I am advocating to have federal lands sold. I'm advocating for following the law, as indicated on here, that there are some parcels that would be available for sale. and the BLM will identify those. As far as others, I'm not sure that I fully understand. I will tell you that one of the bills that I'm pushing forward with is a no net gain bill. And that is that the federal government already owns 612 million acres. I do not believe that the federal government should have more. I would like to see a no net gain bill. And what that means is that, let's say that they wanted to buy 30 acres somewhere. That would only require that particular agency to divest itself of 30 acres elsewhere. Especially in a state like Wyoming with 48% of our surface estate owned by the feds. When we have such a heavy footprint, I don't want the federal government buying more land in Wyoming. It's increasing the cost of land for others. It's limiting our ultimate development. And I also think in the private sector we do a better job of management. Now, I'm going to say, I think that there are some really, really good BLM and Forest Service employees out here. I work with them. I think we have some great federal land management employees who work out in the field, but a lot of the problem comes from the regulations out of Washington, D.C., again, such as the roadless rule. If you were to ask most people who work in the work for the Forest Service, they will tell you that the roadless rule was really devastating to their ability to properly manage the resources that they're responsible for. So again, it's the policies that come out of Washington, D.C. that create the problems. But I do believe that, and I know that this is an area where we have a lot of federal land employees, and I think they do a great job. I work with a lot of them, and I did as a private attorney as well. I do think that we've got to address the issue of the federal government owning land. But right now, and especially if we can get more done in terms of actual management, and in this area, again, that's going to be our Forest Service lands. I would love to see more active management of our Forest Service lands here so that we have additional economic development. We need the resources. Building costs are astronomically expensive in this country, and part of it is because we do not produce our own timber. How can our local senior centers provide services to growing elderly population with a 25% cut to HHS? I'm not quite sure what that is in reference to. I'm not sure what that references. But again, if you want to get a hold of my office and ask that question and explain what the 25% cut is, that would be fine. Do you believe that the judicial branch has no place in our government as our founding fathers believed, or do you think a president should have unchecked power and usurp the Constitution and U.S. laws? So I very much believe in our judicial branch. I practiced in it for many, many years. And I also do not believe that the president has unchecked powers to usurp the Constitution or U.S. laws. U.S. laws restrict the amount of money individual citizens can donate to a candidate, $3,500 per election, as a way to limit an individual's influence on those in power and making it less likely decisions will be made on the basis of who curried the most favor. With Trump's meme coin, it is now possible for rich people around the world to directly curry favor with the president in total anonymity. What are your thoughts on the Trump meme coin and its potential to create political favors for the president? I don't know exactly what you are talking about. I don't know what that is referencing.
Cryptocurrency.
Oh.
His coin.
The cryptocurrency.
Yep.
He and his family are making money.
So, you're talking about what he's doing in that space of cryptocurrency, or what Congress is doing with cryptocurrency?
Trump meme coin.
Trump has created his own cryptocurrency.
I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of that.
The Wall Street Journal.
Oil producers across the country say they're thinking twice about taking on new drilling projects because Trump's trade war is driving down the price of oil and driving up the cost of drilling. Why are you supporting Trump's tariffs, especially when they're hurting Wyoming by decreasing fluid mineral revenues and increasing an already high cost of living? That's not what they're telling me. I can tell you that our oil producers and our mineral producers, our energy producers, are absolutely ecstatic. When I meet with them, they are absolutely over the moon with the policy changes coming out of this administration in terms of their ability to produce. Thank you for fighting for us. You're feisty. Thank you. Thank you. That was good timing, wasn't it? I just made that up. No, I didn't. I did this right here. It's right here. All right, I have time for one more question. I bet it's going to be really good here. You guys, I really have enjoyed this. I know that there are some people who are mad at me in here and that don't support me. I get that. I understand that. That's the way that our system works. But it is still very important for me to come here and engage with you. And I'm willing to talk to anybody. But again, we have to find a way to be able to do it civilly and in a manner that doesn't violate the rights of other people. When I was in Laramie, there were over 500 people who attended that night. And I did it. I went through with it. It lasted the full hour of any other town hall that I've done. What I was sad about was that there were a lot of people there who wanted to have that dialogue, even if they disagreed with me. What I was really horrified about is the number of people who were screaming profanities and using obscene gestures towards me for no other reason than they disagree with my politics. And I want to commend you. Because I do understand. I can see you shaking your heads. I know which ones are angry in here. I can see it. It's very obvious to me. That's okay. I appreciate the fact that you're here. I appreciate the fact that you're willing to come and engage and that you're willing to write these questions. I've tried to answer them to the best of my ability and to be honest with you about what I'm doing. I'm not perfect. I'm going to make mistakes. President Trump isn't perfect, and he's going to make mistakes. Same with Elon Musk. Same with others in the administration. Perfection has never been the requirement of being in politics or engaging in our form of government. And I don't think that we want it to be. We're all human. We're trying to represent you. I represent Wyoming to the very best of my ability. I love Wyoming. I love my state. Most of my family's here. I want the best for our country. I want the best for our state. I want the best for our young people. I want jobs. I want to make sure that we continue to have the freedoms and the independence that we do. I think one of the reasons that I look at Europe with such sorrow is because they are reverting to a form of government that isn't going to benefit anyone who lives there. And they're doing it out of fear. And we can't govern out of fear. We need to govern with boldness. We need to be accountable. We need to be we need to do what we think is right in the circumstance. And again, there might be times that I make mistakes. And there's going to be times that you're going to disagree. Actually, there's some in here that will probably disagree with every single thing I do, including the way I tie my shoes. That's the way our government is. But I commit to you that I will always do what I think is in the best interest of Wyoming. I will always do what I think is the best interest. Please resurrect RECA. The Uranium and Radiation is Cradled Grave. The 1971 Act and the 2024 stoppage of this act is a disservice to all post-1971 miners. Absolutely agree. I have a bill. I am working with Josh Hawley in the Senate. We are trying to find a resolution for RECA. One of the very first bills that I ever introduced was to try to extend the benefits through 1978. When OSHA came into effect so that we could cover additional people who were affected by uranium mining. and to make sure that we are providing that service. I was very, very sad when it lapsed last year. I have a bill that would appropriate, I think it's $500 million to address this particular situation, to provide medical care for people who were in that industry prior to 1978. The bill that I am working on with Josh Hawley would extend it a little bit beyond that, and also extend the group of people who would be covered by it. I don't know that I can give you a timeline of when we might be able to get that bill through. I would hope that we can do it by the end of the year, but I can tell you, for whoever asked this question, it is a priority of mine to make sure that we get that program reauthorized and we get it fully funded so that we can take care of the people who are in that industry. So, again, thank you all for coming tonight. I appreciate you being here.
This is 307 Net Info, connecting community.